Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, how afraid should we be? Brown people on airplanes, people praying in airports. Is it really scary? I have a Pearls Before Swine cartoon. There's a little comic strip that's in our local paper. They're all over the country. This crazed duck who's always smoking a cigarette and wearing a combat hat. And he's talking to the pig who owns the house. And he says, sir, religious zealots have taken over the streets. It's a mob scene. People with funny head coverings. They're chanting fundamentalist dogma. Call retreat, sir. The great holy war is upon us. So the pig goes, looks out the window, and there's three people standing there with red caps on. And they're singing, away in a manger, no crib for his bed. The little Lord Jesus laid down his sweet head. And the pig comes back in, and the duck says, let me guess, they put a fatwa on me. No. Ann Jacobson is with us, however, speaking of this whole broad realm. She's a journalist for Women's Wall Street Journal, author of Terror in the Skies, Why 9/11 Could Happen Again, womenswallstreetjournal.com, the website, and an author also of a rather controversial piece, What Happened on United Airlines Flight 925. Ann Jacobson, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you for having me.
And first of all, you wrote this piece that was published on the Wall Street Journal and Women's Wall Street Journal online. And, well, first of all, tell us what happened.
Well, I think you might be confusing United 925 with the first piece I wrote, which was about a flight that I was on myself.
Yes, I am.
So that was Northwest Flight 327 a couple summers ago in 2004. Also on the flight were 14 Syrian men who acted like they would hijack the plane.
Right,
and
this
of course,
is called Terror in the Skies Again.
Absolutely, and that was the one that some 15 million people read around the world. It was translated into Swahili and Chinese, among others. But, of course, in a post-9/11 world, people were wondering how on earth could this type of situation happen again? And then the other half of the people were wondering whether or not I was stark raving mad and perhaps a bit racist. So it created a great debate.
Yeah, well, tell me if I'm mischaracterizing this, because I've read your article. In fact, I have it here in front of me. I have several of them. And I've read some of the articles that have characterized you as a screaming racist and being hyperbolic and all that kind of thing. And basically, you were on this flight with your husband, and there were a bunch of Muslim guys on the plane. It turned out later, we found out that they were musicians on their way to Los Angeles for a performance, but they had strange shaped carry-on objects. They got up to go to the bathroom. You were concerned. You mentioned it to the flight attendant. The flight attendant said she was concerned. But she also said, by the way, don't tell anybody, but there's air marshals on the plane. You know, everything's under control. How do you respond to the those folks who say, hey, you know, we need to calm down here?
Well, calming down really isn't the issue. The issue is security. The issue is, you know, the letter of the law. The issue is the Department of Homeland Security Act. All of those things which the 14 Syrians, who, by the way, their cover was that they were a band, violated, you know, one after the next. I mean, these were 14 guys flying on expired visas with one.
So you're still suggesting that these guys were terrorists?
Well, it's not a suggestion. It's let me put it to you this way. One of the most fascinating things about the whole scenario was after I reported the facts in my article and also some opinions in my article, the FBI was very quick out of the gate to say that nothing happened on Flight 327. And that became their, you know, log line, so to speak. But flash forward 22 months, just last spring, and you find out that the United States government spent 22 months investigating the flight, had to go back to Congress for more money because the investigation was so complex. And when they went to release their report in May of 2006, they classified the entire report. So the flight on which nothing happened is now classified.
Now, they're saying that they classified it because it would reveal their investigative techniques. A federal air marshal spokesman Dave Adams told the New York Times that, contrary to what you said, seven of the musicians did not get up during the plane's final approach and take positions at the forward and rear restrooms. Per the flight attendants, they were already standing in the aisle, and the seatbelt sign was illuminated. The flight attendants asked them to take their seats, and they did. One of the air marshals on the flight told Time magazine that none of the men gathered at the first-class restroom during the final approach, like you said, and he said that there was no terror. This is the guy who was there.
I know, and isn't it amazing what the Homeland Security officials will do to toe the party line?
Well, what if they're telling the truth? I mean, are you suggesting that we should start profiling people who look Muslim?
Well, let me answer the first
essentially, that's what you did, is it not?
Hang on. Let me answer the first part of your question first, which is that if you read my book, in the end, you will find that Dave Adams himself admits to lying on CNN about the investigation. So that's a very important fact, and that is officially on the record. But as far as profiling goes, and as far as me being a racist, it's simply nonsense. And to that end, I will say that 2 weeks before Flight 327, I myself, who used to be a business and finance writer, was in a very small Muslim village on the border of Pakistan and India. Obviously, had to go through a lot of plane rides full of Muslims to get there, and it's preposterous to think that I'm afraid of Muslims or some kind of a racist. It's silly. It doesn't make any sense.
Why get nervous and why write the piece?
Well, the reason that I was nervous on the flight was because something happened. And I've never moved off of that position, and I have no intention of moving off that position, because that is the fact.
Yeah. Recently, in fact, 2 weeks ago, there was a conviction in a case where a terrorist had deadly sarin nerve gas and C4 explosives. He sold them to an undercover agent. The FBI alleges that this person who, talking about local officials, that was going to take these into Congress and blow up Congress when it was in session. This is what he was convicted of. You would think that this would be a major screaming story, that we've got a terrorist caught in the United States with C4 explosives and sarin nerve gas, selling it to the FBI and talking about going in and blowing up Congress. Any idea why that wasn't dealt with? I mean, this is an actual conviction in a court of law. The arrest was made on October 24, 2004, post 9/11. The conviction was 2 weeks ago. Any idea why that didn't get anything near the coverage of you being on a plane where 14 Syrians stood up and went to the bathroom?
Well, I certainly think the case that you're talking about merits some investigation, and I thank you for that tip, and I hadn't heard of it.
Well, here's the deal. The guy that I'm talking about, his name is Demetrius Van Crocker. He's white, he's Christian, he's a member of a white supremacist group.
Okay.
I have a list of about 30 of these guys. Here's another one, October 13th. Ivan Dwayne Braden, former National Guardsman, discharged from an Iraq-bound unit after they discovered that he was a little nutty. He's trying to kill rabbis. He built up an armory in his house. The list goes on and on. Neo-Nazi skinhead Sean Gillespie, April 1st, videotapes himself as he firebombs Temple B'nai Israel in Oklahoma City Synagogue. October 10th, police arrest Norman Somerville, finding a huge weapons cache in his property in northern Michigan that includes six machine guns, a powerful anti-aircraft gun, thousands of rounds of ammunition, hundreds of pounds of gunpowder, and an underground bunker. They find two vehicles he calls his war wagons, on which prosecutors say he mounted machine guns. This did not make the press. None of this stuff is making the press because these are all white guys who, like Tim McVeigh, are part of this left behind, you know, let's bring down America in the name of Christianity movement. And yet, you know, 14 Syrian guys on an airplane scare you, and it's translated into 16 languages. What's wrong with this picture, Ann Jacobson?
Well, I think that all of the points that you brought up about the white supremacist, it's terrific, and it sounds like you are bringing that issue to the public forum. You're talking about it on national radio, and good for you. All of us have our different beats that we choose to cover. I was in a situation which absolutely, I believe, was a dry run for a terrorist attack, and I have many counterterrorism agents, federal agents, in the field that have confirmed that. So that is my beat. And you know, goodness, it's a democracy, and we all choose the stories we want to write. And we
do you think we should be profiling people in airports?
Well, you know, I have over 100 federal agents in the field that are sources to me, and what they always say to me is that profiling is part of law enforcement. So, absolutely.
But you profile based on behavior, not based on appearance. I mean, the two women who blew up airplanes in the Soviet Union were elderly widows. I mean,
well, that's, you have your facts a little skewered there. According to the State Department report, they were what are called black widows, and they were widows of
Chechen fighters, and one was in her 50s and one was in her 60s. Were they not?
Well, the age of the individuals.
We've got to wrap it up. Ann Jacobson, the website I have for you, womenswallstreet.com, your book, Terror in the Skies, Why 9/11 Could Happen Again. Is there a better website for you, Ann?
Oh, you know, that's great. People can read me all over the place.
Great. Okay. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks
I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
Now, back to Tom Hartman on The Al Franken Show, here on Air America Radio.
The old-fashioned, but I believe it's true, that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
And welcome back to the Real Free Speech Zone.
Liberal, liberal.
Tom Harbin here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Now, I am sure, and I really believe this, that Ann Jacobson is a decent person of goodwill and obviously a very competent writer for the Wall Street Journal women's section. And I don't want to make this about her. I thought that, however, bringing her on and having her tell this story, which has, as she said, spread around the world. These 3,000 words travel all around the world and in all these different languages about these 14 Syrian guys on this plane who, it turns out, were musicians heading to L.A. for a performance, or at least that was their cover story, is a good way of setting up this larger topic, which is that we have seen this movie before. It's called creating a them. It's called objectifying other people. There are some folks who have turned it into an absolute art form. For example, Pat Robertson.
It's amazing how the Muslims deal with history and the truth with violence. They don't understand what reason dialogue is.
Yeah, Pat Robertson, who apparently doesn't remember the Crusades or the Spanish Inquisition, or for that matter, the recent battles between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland.
Who ever heard of such a bloody, bloody, brutal type of religion? But that's what it is. It is not a religion of peace.
I would suggest it to Pat Robertson if he wants to, bone up, fill in, whatever, learn all about blood and religion, that he read Jeremiah. Actually, Jeremiah isn't even the worst. I mean, there's several books in the Old Testament in the New Testament for that matter, in Revelation. I mean, within my religion, within Christianity, there's a lot of general craziness. Within Judaism, within all the religions of the world, except for Buddhism, you will find that. But there's this professional, there's this let's be afraid stuff that's going on in the United States big time. Glenn Beck interviewing the first Muslim member of Congress.
Sir, prove to me that you are not working with our enemies.
Yeah, real good, Glenn, real good. And by the way, Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell saying Islam is a religion of violence, right? But when the planes crashed into the towers, it was because their Christian God said, "Hey, good plan, let's do it."
Man, I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, "You helped this happen."
Well, I totally concur. And the problem is we've adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible as a free society for what the top people do. And the top people, of course, the court system.
Ah, yes, bring down the judges. And in fact, they go on to say we actually deserved it.
What we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if, in fact, God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve.
Well, Gary, that's my feeling. I think we've just seen the antechamber to terror. We haven't even begun to see what they can do to the major population.
And after Keith Ellison was attacked by Glenn Beck on CNN, now Representative Virgil Good, the Republican from Virginia, has sent out a letter to his right-wing Republican supporters saying, if American citizens don't wake up and adopt the Virgil Good position on immigration, there will likely be many more Muslims elected to office and demanding the use of the Quran to be sworn into office. Actually, you don't have any Bible or book to get sworn into office. You just raise your right hand. Denny Hastert put his other hand on the podium. That's a photo op with the Bible. But nonetheless, Good, you know, reality doesn't seem to impinge in the world of Republicans. So Good continues. Virgil Good, the Republican from Virginia, he says, I fear that in the next century we will have many more Muslims in the United States if we do not adopt a strict immigration policy that I believe are necessary to preserve the values and beliefs traditional to the American state, the United States of America, to prevent our resources from being swamped. Yeah. Well, Michael Savage, for example, Michael Weiner, excuse me, is his real name, his thoughts on this.
An outright ban on Muslim immigration. I would also make the construction of mosques illegal in America and the speaking of English only in the streets of the United States the law.
And why would you do that, Mr. Weiner, Savage?
It's a bloodthirsty religionist practice over there by a bunch of throwbacks, and we're to kill them.
Yeah, and we're to kill them. Now, again, as I said, the bigger picture here is not characterizing these guys as cranks or as racists, and certainly not our first guest, who, as I said, I think is absolutely not in that category. But it is feeding that camp.
Now, it's long past time for the USA to stop the nonsense and institute profiling at airports. We're at war with Muslim fanatics.
Yeah, as Mr. O'Reilly says. So where have we seen this movie before? After the break, I want to share with you the actual words of a guy who used this very strategy to take his nation down a very strange path that many suggest perhaps we're going today. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. TomHartmann.com. Drop into our live chat room. 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the place where we've run rings around the right wing 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartmann here with you. By the way, just a quick heads up, January 5th, I'll be in Pittsburgh doing this program live, doing my show live from WPTT, an affiliate that's been carrying our program for, a year and a half now, almost 2 years. That should be a lot of fun. We'll be doing a book signing that night, by the way, January 5th at Borders at 7 p.m. in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. And on January 6th, this is all for my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, What We Can Do About It, which, by the way, Amazon is now offering an additional 5% off, 45% off the regular price. And January 6th in Minneapolis, I'll be signing books at Majors & Quinn, it's the bookstore, 2 o'clock, that Saturday. So just a heads up on that for those who are curious. The problem with racial profiling, the problem with seeing a them out there, the problem with politicians who are using the idea of a them to promote them, to promote fear, basically, for a fear-based system. First of all, racial profiling. Say, why don't we go after these guys? It was young Muslim men who flew planes into the towers. Let's go after them. It was a white guy who blew up Oklahoma City's federal building. A white Christian guy. Should we go after them, too? It was older women who blew up Russian airliners. There was a baby's teddy bear that was caught by TSA with somebody trying to smuggle a gun in a baby's teddy bear. So, it's like, where do you, the bottom line, profiling, first of all, seems rational, but it's not. Secondly, if you're looking for Muslims, I mean, there are 65 nations in the world that are majority Islamic, including the Philippines, Indonesia, a whole bunch of African nations. None of those citizens are going to fit any kind of profile that looks like Arab guys. You've got John Walker Lynn, you know, your basic white Anglo-Saxon guy, Richard Reed, British, half British, half Caribbean, coming from Britain, half African-American, but, you know, looking again, not like the profile. And you've got these right-wingers out there saying, oh, the solution is profiling. Yes, of course, we need to be careful. I can tell you, I have been through, particularly Israel, going in and out of Israel a number of times, but I've been through airports in other countries as well where I have gotten the grill treatment, particularly back when the Soviet Union was the Soviet Union, going in and out of Russia, or going into East Berlin. I spent 10 minutes with the security guy going into East Berlin one time. You know, every question, going through all my stuff, everything. This was for a day trip. Yes, of course, and the bottom line is, interestingly, Israel does this the best, is they're looking for your behavior. They're asking you a simple question. Where are you going? Who do you know here? When was the last time you were here? What's your job? What do you do? And anytime you answer something in a way that kind of indicates that you may not be telling the truth, then they start drilling a little deeper. That's called psychographic profiling. And if you really think that that's what we have to worry about, then, you know, let's do psychographic profiling. But the guys who are running around asking for racial profiling are the ones who are trying to promote an agenda of fear. And that agenda of fear, particularly of an other, is an old trick. Joe McPherson used to be the producer of our program back when we started this show 3.5 years ago. We were on Sirius Satellite Radio and 20-some-odd radio stations, and being syndicated by IE America Radio, me and Mike Malloy and Peter Werby and a few other guys, and women as well. Nancy Skinner had a show on IE America. And my producer then, Joe McPherson, and he took Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf and replaced the word Germany with the word America. And in a few places, replaced the word Jews with the word liberals. Now, in a few places, Hitler actually used the word liberals, so it's in both. But just consider this, or, you know, replace it with Muslims if you want. If you want it to be, you know, Michael Wiener speaking today, or Bill O'Reilly. It must be admitted, this is chapter 10, Mein Kampf. It must be admitted that all this was partly the result of extraordinarily crafty tactics on the part of the liberals on the one hand, and obvious official stupidity or naivete on the other. The liberals were too clever to allow a simultaneous attack to be made on the whole of their press. No one section functioned as cover for the other. The national papers, also in liberal hands, knew how to camouflage themselves as well as model examples of objectivity. They studiously avoided harsh language, knowing well that idiots are capable of judging only by external appearances and never able to penetrate to the real depth and meaning of anything. This form of human frailty was carefully studied and understood by the liberal press. Certainly in days to come, the liberals will raise a tremendous cry throughout their newspapers once a hand is laid on their favorite nest, once a move is made to put an end to the scandalous liberal press, and once this instrument which shapes public opinion is brought under conservative control and no longer left in the hands of liberals and enemies of the people. I am certain that this will be easier for us than it was for our fathers. The scream of the 12-inch shrapnel is more penetrating than the hiss from 1,000 liberal newspaper vipers. Therefore, let them go on with their hissing. By means of the liberal press, the liberals spread the colossal falsehood about American militarism throughout the world and try to inculpate America by every possible means, while at the same time, the Democratic Party refused to assent to the measures that were necessary for the adequate training of our national defense forces. What soon gave me cause for very serious consideration were the activities of the liberals in certain branches of life, into the mystery of which I penetrated little by little. Was there any shady undertaking, any form of foulness, especially in cultural life, in which at least one liberal did not participate? By putting the probing knife carefully at that point of abscess, one immediately discovered, like a maggot in a putrescent body, a little liberal who was often blinded by the sudden light. In my eyes, the charge against liberalism became a grave one the moment I discovered the liberal activities in the press, in art, in literature, in the theater. All unctuous protests were now more or less futile. Here was a pestilence, a moral pestilence, with which the public is being infected. I am happy at last to know for certain that a liberal is not an American. Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf. The word Jew replaced with the word liberal, the word Germany replaced with the word America. By my producer, years ago, Joe McPherson. And it raises the issue of, you know, what road are we traveling down? In the next hour, I want to share with you some excerpts from some folks who were actually in Germany at the time, back in the 1930s, and what they saw happening. Is this the road that we're traveling down with this absolute hysteria that is being promoted on the Reich? I mean,
it's a bloodthirsty religionist practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks of where to kill them.
Really? Cynthia in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Cynthia, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. And I agree with what you're saying. I think I've heard you quote from Milton Mayer's book before.
Yeah, that's who I'm going to be quoting from in the next
hour. Okay, great. But I have another theory on this. And the reason I'm saying this, I was watching Hardball the other evening, and Milt Bearden, who was our Pakistan station chief when we were training and funding the Mujahideen, flatly denied we were doing this when he was on with Chris Matthews the other evening. I was stunned.
Yeah.
You know, we use some of these people.
Actually, he didn't deny that we were funding them. He denied that we created them. He said the Soviets created them by invading.
Yeah, no, but he's not telling the truth.
Well, you know, there actually is some truth to that. The Soviets, when they invaded Afghanistan, just like when you invade any country,
it's
like, you know, if Canada invaded the United States, odds are, Cynthia, you and I would be out there, you know, looking for a gun to fight back the Canadians.
Yes, but we allowed people like, what's his, Hakhmadiar, I can't even pronounce his name. We funded him, allowed him to function. And I think we still do that, like with the MEK in Iran. We've got them over there in Iran doing things.
So this is the biggest problem we have right now. We're funding insurgent groups in Syria that have Bashar really upset. And it's probably one of the reasons why the Bush administration is going to have a very difficult time negotiating with Syria and getting them on board with it, because we're actively in the background trying to overthrow them.
Yes, and the point I want to make is think about who the United States is training and supporting, and do not demonize any group of people. But we are using certain false people to commit false flag attacks. We've done it before. We'll do it again. That's the point I wanted to make.
Yeah, well, you made it very well, Cynthia. Thank you very much for the call. And you know, well said. I mean, this is the fundamental bottom line is back to FDR. I mean, you know, here it is.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And I'm telling you, there's a lot of voices out there that just want us to experience that terror.
It's a bloodthirsty religionist practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks of where to kill them.
And it goes on and on, and even on CNN. I mean, I just find this so incredible.
Sir, prove to me that you are not working with our enemies.
And the first step in establishing an anti-democratic form of government is creating a them. The very first step. And the first step in creating a them is identifying the them and then causing everybody to be afraid of them, and then to create an infrastructure that says, oh, there's a them. And, you know, whether it's they have to wear a little yellow star, or it's we're going to profile them in the airports. 45 minutes past the hour.
Oh, you better watch out, I'm telling you why. The FAA doubts that Santa will fly. Santa Claus is coming by ground. His bags are too weird, they're posting his bum. They're checking his beard, he's getting the one. Santa isn't leaving the ground. weird. They'll post a reward, cause last time he flew, he tried to board his sleigh with shampoo. TSA does not like his ill. He might spring on some cookies and milk.
Yes. Welcome back. Nine minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you in the place where being progressive never felt so good. In a bizarre combination of the war on terror and the war on Christmas, the Bush administration canceled this year's Yuletide celebration after arresting Santa Claus for aiding and abetting terrorism and designating him as an enemy combatant. Speaking of snatching and banishing people, I want to get into this whole thing with what's going on at Swift. Tomorrow we'll do that in some depth. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez announced that Old Saint Nick had been tracked by the FBI for some time since he fit the classic terrorist profile, a bearded holy man who took flying lessons, repeatedly entered and left this country without a passport, controlled a tightly knit cell of subordinates who manufactured concealed packages, and did his work in the dark of night. Indeed. Gonzalez further stated that based on warrantless intercepts of phone calls and emails between the North Pole and Detroit, Michigan, U.S. authorities were able to uncover Santa's naughty and nice list that implicated him in various al-Qaeda-related activities. By all accounts, he's being held at Guantanamo, where he reportedly has been waterboarded, forced to live in squalor among reindeer feces, and purposely left alone with a thick black belt to encourage himself to hang himself. Yeah, that Don Davis, satiricalpolitical.com. Andy Borowitz weighs in on this on borowitzreport.com. CNN anchor Lou Dobbs devoted his entire news broadcast last night to a searing expose of Santa Claus, in which he warned the legendary fat man not to cross the U.S. border with Canada on Christmas Eve. His Broken Borders segment. Mr. Dobbs said, to our knowledge, Santa Claus is a resident of the North Pole and therefore is doing business in the United States as an undocumented worker. Demanded a full investigation into the country of origin of the items in Santa's gift sack. We have reason to believe that Santa's sack is full of cheap gift items manufactured in China, only adding to America's already burgeoning trade deficit, the CNN anchor said, pledging to stand guard on the U.S. border with Canada on Christmas Eve and to shoot down Santa's sleigh on sight. Mr. Dobbs directed his last words at St. Nick himself. Santa Claus, lest you write me off as some sort of lunatic, I must warn you, I'm not alone. Pat Buchanan agrees with me. Actually, to some extent, I agree with him, too. It's really the issue is, how, you know, what do we do about this? Should we be racially profiling? I mean, this whole concept of the other, this is a really important one, and one that I want to spend some time with today. There's also a lot of news. In fact, Ahmadinejad and the Iranians and the Indians and the nuclear reactors and the nuclear technology, which I will be sharing with you at the top of the next hour, really actually play into all of this. Abe in Somerville, Massachusetts, our number 866-440-THOM. Hey, Abe, welcome to the program. Abe?
Hello?
Hey, good morning. Or afternoon, I guess, in Massachusetts. You're on the
Hi,
air.
Tom. My name is Ed.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's not a bad name.
Yeah.
Two things. The second, by far, the more important. First, terror is an emotion. Courage is its polar opposite. Courage is the price of freedom. It's what we have to do. If we don't have it, we're sunk.
Yeah, that's why I played that clip from Roosevelt. As
I know, it was beautiful.
Segment.
And thank you.
I mean, here we have, historically, we have had, you know, presidents like Roosevelt and Wilson and Lincoln and Washington. James Madison, during the War of 1812, had to flee the White House. I mean, you talk about, you know, the Bush says, well, this is the first time we've ever been attacked on American soil. Nonsense.
Wrong.
The British and the Canadians occupied the United States and burned the White House down in 1812. And James Madison didn't say, oh, gee, we need to do away with the Bill of Rights. In fact, you know, he had been one of the authors of it.
Well, the Bill of Rights. Let me tell you something. Working with Don Westcott, the voice of Nova,
yeah,
and David Grimes. I used to do a little media. What I'd do is I'd solve problems. I'd sit at a conference table, listen to them, and say, try this. Mm-hmm. And they'd do it and make money. Anyways, what we did is a reading of the Bill of Rights and Constitution and Amendments. It's on CBR for Constitution Bill of Rights. It's on CBRproject-podcast.org.
That's great. Yeah. In fact, my book of the month this month for BuzzFlash.com, for the last 2 years, I've done a, you know, they call it Tom Hartman's Independent Thinker Book of the Month. And it's the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and Thomas Jefferson's Bill for Religious Freedom in Virginia. It's a little
Thank you, sir.
In your shirt pocket. You can get it over at buzzflash.com, and it supports the website. But Ed, good point and well made. And thank you very much for the call.
Good
I appreciate
morning,
it.
Tom.
Don in Albany, Oregon. Hey, Don, we've got to wrap up in just a second.
Okay,
what's up?
I was just going to say, I know what you're talking about. Playing on and promoting the fears of change and difference, keeping the paranoia amped up as much as they dare. But, you know, they're not going to go too far with the paranoia. They don't want to totally paralyze us.
Well, I think they do. I think they you had Dick Cheney out there saying that if you vote for Democrats, you're voting to destroy the United States.
I know.
I mean, that really is an attempt at paralysis. It really is. In fact, after the break, I'll share with you a Republican perspective on whether people should even vote who are not Republicans. 56 minutes past the hour. Should we be racially profiling? Should we be religiously profiling? Is there even such a thing as a war on terror? Or is this all part of a plan to terrorize America by people within the United States, people within our government, even? To gain political advantage, purely for political power, or maybe to make some money for them and their oil company buddies. We'll be back after the news.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Okay, the big news, Iran. Here's another other. Iran is now a nuclear power, its President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad declared Wednesday, according to the Islamic Republic News Agency. Everybody's all freaking out. Now, he's talking about they have the ability to generate nuclear electricity, or electricity by use of, you know, nuclear plants. It's being treated in the American press as if he's talking about building nuclear bombs. Iran has actually signed the non-proliferation agreement, and Ahmadinejad has said he will allow nuclear inspectors into Iran from the United Nations. On the other hand, India has refused to sign the pact, will not allow in inspectors, has already secretly built a nuclear bomb, and now the U.S. has decided to sell them nuclear technology. And to add insult to injury, President Bush, in signing the bill, added a signing statement, because the bill had, I was talking this morning with Congressman Earl Blumenauer, he said, well, you know, we put a lot of provisions into the bill, I'm paraphrasing now, a lot of provisions into the bill that would restrict how they could use the technology. Bush, in his signing statement, says, and it would be the executive branch, Bush's branch of government, that would be responsible for enforcing those provisions of law created by the legislative branch. Bush says, approval of the act does not constitute my adoption of the statements of policy as U.S. foreign policy. In other words, he doesn't have to pay attention to it. The president declared that 8 sections of the bill in total had to be construed, quote, in a manner consistent with the president's constitutional authority to protect and control information that could impair bloody, bloody, blah. In other words, he's just ignoring this stuff. This article by Michael Rostin over at the Ross Story, rossstory.com. This is one of 1,097 signing statements the president has attached to the legislation. So it's all about, you know, well, gee, the people that it's useful for us to be afraid of, let's be very afraid of them. The people it's not so useful for us to be afraid of, let's not be so afraid of them. Anti-government extremist Charles Ray Polk. This is just, you know, let's just look at the last decade. July 28, 1995. Anti-government extremist Charles Ray Polk, arrested after trying to purchase a machine gun from an undercover police officer, later indicted by a federal grand jury for plotting to blow up the IRS building in Austin, Texas. At the time of his arrest, he's trying to purchase plastic explosive to add to an already huge arsenal he's amassed. October 9th, 95, saboteurs derail an Amtrak passenger train near Hydard, Arizona, killing one person, injuring scores of others. An anti-government message signed by the Sons of Gestapo is left behind. Like with the anthrax killer, the perpetrator remains at large. November 9th, 95, Oklahoma constitutional militia leader Willie Ray Lampe, his wife Cecilia, and another man, John LaBird, are arrested as they prepare explosives to bomb numerous targets, including the Southern Poverty Law Center, gay bars, and abortion clinics. December 18, an Internal Revenue Service employee discovers a plastic drum filled with ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. This is what Timothy McVeigh used to blow up the federal building. In a parking lot behind an IRS building in Reno, Nevada, it failed to explode a day earlier when its 3-foot fuse went out prematurely. January 1896, Peter Kevin Langan, the pseudonymous Commander Pedro, who leads the underground Aryan Republican Army, is arrested after a shootout with the FBI in Ohio. Along with six other suspects, he's charged in connection with 22 bank robberies. April 11, 96, anti-government activist Ray Hamblin charged with illegal possession of explosives after authorities find 460 pounds of the high-explosive Tovex, 746 pounds of Anfo blasting agent, and 15 homemade hand grenades in his property in Hood River, Oregon. April 12, 96, apparently inspired by reading a neo-Nazi tract, Larry Wayne Shoemaker kills one black man and wounds seven others, including a reporter. In his home, along with racist literature, they find weapons, including 17 long guns, 20,000 rounds of ammunition, several knives, and countless military manuals. April 26, 96, two leaders of the militia at large of the Republic of Georgia, Robert Edward Starr III and William James McCary, Jr., are charged with manufacturing shrapnel bombs for distribution to militia members. July 29, 96, Washington State militia leader John Pittner and seven others are arrested with weapons and explosive charges in connection with a plot to build pipe bombs. October 11, 96, seven members of the Mountaineer militia are arrested in a plot to blow up the FBI's National Fingerprint Center, where 1,000 people work in West Virginia. January 16, 97, two anti-personnel bombs. Now, this was all during the Clinton administration, all these arrests. Clinton could have turned this into a national hysteria had he wanted. Two anti-personnel bombs, the second clearly designed to kill arriving law enforcement and rescue workers, explode outside an abortion clinic in Sandy Springs, Georgia, a suburb of Atlanta. I lived in Atlanta when that happened. January 22nd, 97, I remember it happening. Authorities raid the Martinson, Illinois home of former Marine Ricky Slayers, an alleged KKK member, discovering 35,000 rounds of heavy ammunition, armor-piercing shells, smoke and tear gas grenades, live shells for grenade launchers, artillery shells, and other military gear. I mean, it's just that this is chronological, starting in 95. It runs, I don't know, their page numbers here, 10 pages long, of small type, all the way back to, you know, the more recent stuff that I read an hour ago at the beginning of this program. Where these guys, you know, FBI raids the Noonday, Texas home of William Crayer and storage facilities he rented in the area, discovering 500,000 rounds of ammunition, 65 pipe bombs, remote control briefcase. This was just a couple of years ago. Almost 2 pounds of deadly sodium cyanide. Also found our components to convert the cyanide into a bomb capable of killing thousands, along with white supremacist and anti-government material. On June 4, 2003, federal agents in California announced the former accountant John Noster is under investigation. Officials found incendiary devices in his stolen camper, in his storage facilities, 3 pipe bombs, 6 barrels of jet fuel, 5 assault weapons, cannon fuse, a large amount of ammunition, and $188,000 in cash. Norman Somerville, arrested October 10th. Huge weapons cache in his property in northern Michigan that includes 6 machine guns, a powerful anti-aircraft gun, thousands of rounds of ammunition, hundreds of pounds of gunpowder, an underground bunker. I mean, it goes on and on. We're not hearing about that because these are not brown people. These are not the Muslims that we should be afraid of. right?
An outright ban on Muslim immigration. I would also make the construction of mosques illegal in America and the speaking of English only in the streets of the United States the law.
Yeah, thank you, Michael Weiner. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Angus in Edmonton, Canada. We were reading about Lou. It was tongue in cheek, of course. Lou Dobbs saying Santa's coming in illegally. You want to take exception to that?
It's just that as a kid, I had always thought that we were the only country to actually have a pole, and I learned later on that we didn't.
That Russia has the North Pole as well. You mean?
That we had in our territory one of the poles. Actually, the northern coast of Ellesmere Island ends just a little beyond the 83rd parallel. I don't know how far territorial waters would go, but Santa is in international waters.
He's not illegal.
Batman on us.
Yeah, so he's not an illegal Canadian, so Lou Dobbs can call
him. He's an illegal nothing. But if we keep it up with the global warming, he's going to have to move to a houseboat.
There you go. See, that's the real war on Christmas. The real war on Santa Claus is melting the North Pole so that he's going to end up swimming.
Oddly enough, we hear nothing about that war on Christmas and all of that kind of rhetoric in Canada.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't have right-wing cranks in Canada?
Oh yeah. Well, you ever heard of Stockwell Day?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Young Earth creationist who is actually in the running to become prime minister.
Yeah,
but
they're not. It must be that you don't have a right-wing press in Canada. You don't have an entire television network controlled by right-wingers.
No, we don't. I only hear that kind of stuff usually from the U.S. media.
Yeah, interesting. Mm-hmm. Angus, thanks for the call, for the heads up. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Oh, my. Philip in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Philip.
Hey, Tom. I thought I was on the wrong program or whatever. I thought it was really broadcast. But, yeah. You know,
that was a live show.
Yeah. Yeah, you were talking about the racial profiling earlier, and I was just wondering, aren't we all guilty of racial profiling?
You know, at a certain level, Philip, we are, and there's actually probably a good impulse behind that. Let me just riff on that a little bit when we come back from the break, because thank you for raising that. However, right now, we're going to do our progressive pop quiz. Today's question, what mythological character may resemble a terrorist and be working in the United States illegally? According to Andy Borowitz. The sixth caller, the correct answer, 1-866-440-THOM. 866-440-8466. Gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Harpin here with you.
Al Franken Show. Now back to guest host Tom Hartman.
Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government is a fine for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow.
Welcome back to the pillow. We'll help you escape the matrix. 21 minutes past the hour. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Our question once again was, what mythological character may resemble a terrorist and be working in the United States illegally? According to Andy Borowitz. And congratulations to John Sullivan in Glendora, California. Hey, John. John knew that the correct answer is Santa Claus or Saint Nick. So, one of our fluffier progressive pop quizzes here, but what the heck. It's an interesting point. Milton Mayer, observed what happened in Germany after the war. He was an American. He was Jewish. He lived in Chicago. He was a writer, a reporter, newspaper reporter. And after the war, he went over to Germany and spent quite a bit of time. As I recall, he spent a year or two there. It's been a few years since I read his book, They Thought They Were Free. And he got to know 10 Germans, just average Germans, and really got inside their heads and wrote down their stories, transcribed their stories. And here's what some of them said. One of them told him, what happened here in Germany was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand, or so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it could not be released because of national security. Boy, that just, the president's, Bush's press conference this morning, here's another one. This separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure, or associated with true patriotic allegiance, or with real social purposes. And all the crises and reforms, and there were real reforms too, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity, than most of us ever had the occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, or on some occasions regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures were that no patriotic German could resent, what they must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing, although one day it is over his head. Another of his correspondents, the people that he was interviewing, said, Pastor Niemöller, you know, the guy who said first they came for the communists and then it ends up, you know, and there was nobody left to come for me. Pastor Niemöller spoke for the thousands and thousands of men like me when he spoke too modestly of himself and said that when the Nazis attacked the communists, he was a little uneasy, but after all, he was not a communist, and so he did nothing. And then they attacked the socialists, he was a little uneasier, but still he was not a socialist, and he did nothing. And then the schools, the press, and the Jews, and so on. And he was always uneasier, but still he did nothing. And then they attacked the church, and he was a churchman, and he did something, but then it was too late. Yes, I said, this is Mayer interviewing him. You see, he went on, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for the one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when the shock comes, will join you in the streets in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even to talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble. Why not? Well, you're not in the habit of doing it. And it's not just fear of standing alone that restrains you. It is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor. And instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside, in the streets, in the general community, everyone seems happy. One hears no protests, certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there are slogans against the government painted on the walls and fences, but in Germany, outside the great cities, perhaps there's not even this. In the university community, in your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do. But what do they say? They say, it's not so bad. You're seeing things. You're an alarmist. And you are an alarmist. You're saying that this must lead to that, and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? How do you know or even surmise the end? On the other hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, they intimidate you. And on the other hand, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. But that one great shocking occasion where tens or hundreds of thousands will join you never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and the smallest, thousands, yes, millions, would have been shocked. If, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come right after the German firm stickers in the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. And so today, George Bush attaches a signing statement to our selling nuclear technology to India. 27 minutes past the hour.
I ain't lived forever, but I've lived enough.
But I've learned to be gentle and I've learned to be tough. I found only two things that last till the end. One is your heroes, the other's your friends.
Hey, welcome back to the place where being progressive never felt so good. Tom Hartman here with you. Lauren tells me that one of our callers, in a friendly way, called and asked that I apologize for calling 50- and 60-year-old women blowing up airplanes in Russia elderly. You're right. That makes me elderly. She says, when you get to 90, you can call me elderly. Good point. I had in front of me an article, as I recall, in Salon.com, which was probably written by somebody in their 20s, to think that somebody in their 50s is elderly. Oh, my. Anyhow. I just want to wrap this up, this one last paragraph, and then I'm going to go to your phone calls here, because it's just a great one. I was reading from Milton, or sharing with you from, well, reading from Milton Mayer's book, They Thought They Were Free, where he went over to Germany and he interviewed these Germans after World War II. And I can tell you, from having lived in Germany, I lived in Germany for a year and a half, 1986 and 87, and I've spent probably the better part of a month in Germany almost every year for the last 25 years. And you know, in increments, you know, a week here, a weekend there, kind of thing. I spent 25, 27 years working for a German-based nonprofit doing international relief work all around the world. I've met a lot of Germans who were around during the Hitler time, and I've heard these kinds of sentiments repeatedly. So this guy, he's talking about how that one great shocking occasion when tens or hundreds of thousands will join you, it never comes. That's the difficulty. He said, if the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and the smallest thousands, yes, millions would have been sufficiently shocked. If, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers on the windows of new non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C is not so much worse than step B, and if you did not make a stand at step B, then why should you at step C, and so on to step D. And one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incidents, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, Jew, swine, collapses it all at once. And you see that everything has changed, and changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, the spirit is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear. And the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, it seems that no one is transformed. But now you live in a system which rules without responsibility, even to God. How is this to be avoided among ordinary men, even among highly educated ordinary men? Meyer's friend asked rhetorically. And then he said, frankly, I don't know. Well, the Germans in the 30s did not have the benefit of looking back at a previous Nazi-like regime and saying, uh-oh, we've seen this movie before. We have that benefit. And so when we see stories like, you know, Ahmadinejad coming out and saying, well, we've got nuclear power now, and Bush saying, oh, well, we're sending another fleet of aircraft carriers to park up alongside Iran, at the same time that Iran is talking about doing an oil bourse denominated in euros. We've seen this movie before. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Mark in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, glad to be on. You know, I'm listening to you. I've been listening for the last hour or so, a lot of it on my cell phone, so I'm getting sort of the unexpurgated stuff. But, you know, what you're talking about, I don't know if you've read the works of Ernest Becker.
I know of Ernest Speckert. You're talking the anthropologist.
Social anthropologist, right, and he wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Denial of Death. And what he talks about, what he spoke about, he's actually passed away, but is that it's our death denial, our fear of our own mortality that causes us to act out in inhumane ways toward other people. And we always are looking for the other or the group that we can be associated with that is our winning group. And so we have to make the other the enemy. So
here's my take on
that. Superior.
Yeah, and I understand that. I understand Becker's position. I think it's more fundamental than that, frankly. And this is, you know, we had a caller earlier, and I said I'll riff on this after the break, and then I should have made a note because I forgot, but I'll do it right now. I believe that we are wired. I mean, literally, that we're not unlike other mammals, that we are wired to have a certain level of egalitarianism. This is where I think that the libertarians and the objectivists and the conservatives are so wrong, that we are wired to sacrifice for others, for example, and that we are wired to protect community, to protect family, to protect kin, to protect clan, and that because we're wired to protect, you know, our young and our family and our community, we are also wired to notice those who are different. And that's actually, at its core, certainly, a positive survival-based mechanism that's wired into us, is to notice who is us and who is them. And as the caller who said, you know, aren't we all guilty of racial profiling? Yes, all of us. Anybody who says that they're not a racist is in denial and a liar, or just doesn't understand. But the difference is, the fundamental difference, at some level, but the fundamental difference is that some of us notice our response to the other and try to control it or put it in a context that's useful and appropriate. And others of us notice our response to the other and turn that into, you know, the Michael Wiener kind of thing. You know, it's where it just runs out of control.
It's a bloodthirsty religionist practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks that were to kill him.
Sorry, and that's
yeah, and that's exactly what Becker talked about.
Yeah.
Was that you know, that we can work, but you know, there have been empirical studies performed that when people are reminded of their own death, of their own impending death, that their sense of creating the other, of acting out toward people who are different, rises.
Well, that makes sense, because if you're protecting your community and your community is under siege, then it becomes more important to be vigilant about who the other is.
There's the need for the heroic. There's the need for being able to be sacrificial, self-sacrificial, but also to take the other out with you.
Yeah. In a biological sense, it makes perfect sense. And in fact, you see that same thing. I mean, if you're walking through the forest and all of a sudden a female quail or pheasant just comes flying out at you, it's because she's trying to hide her nest. She's trying to distract you from the nest. She's willing to sacrifice herself for the young. And it's not, I mean, you know, that's an experience that a lot of people have had. It's true of many, many species. Most mammalian species will sacrifice like that.
Right, but humans are the only ones who can think abstractly and know that one day they're going to die.
Right, and take
and
it.
So
and take
that,
it to
that, that's what makes it unique. Mm-hmm. And you know, I would think that as an evolving species, if we don't kill ourselves with our ecology first, that we would be able to evolve beyond that.
Yeah,
you know, mentally, psychologically, and intellectually.
Sure.
To a level
where
we recognize that and short-circuit that.
Yeah, exactly. And this is where we need to go beyond this right-wing conservative worldview of fear and paranoia that is being promoted by this administration and the cons and the neocons out there, and say, no, wait a minute. This country was not, you know, yes, we have the myth. We have the mythology of Daniel Boone, the coonskin cap, the guy who goes out of the wilderness all by himself and comes back, you know, with a house and lunch and the whole thing. But that's not the reality of America. That's part of the mythology of America. The reality of America is that we are a nation of barn builders. We get together and we raise barns for each other. We get together and we protect each other. Ben Franklin in the 1780s in Philadelphia created the first fire department, and it was required that everybody in town had to have a fire fire bucket. And the fire bucket didn't have a flat bottom. So once you were participating in the fire line, you couldn't set that thing down. You had to work. I mean, it was like enforced community. We have always been about that, and hopefully we always will be about that. Mark, thank you very much.
Well, yeah, and the commons, right.
Yeah, it is, that's the whole point, is the commons. Mark, a good call. Dara in Felton, Delaware. Hey, Dara.
Hi. Somebody said that they don't have any right-wing crazies up in Canada. Mm-hmm. David Frum is one of them.
Oh, he's from Canada.
Yes, he is.
Yeah,
he has a dual citizenship, so I guess he likes to pretend to be an American, but he's really a Canadian. So
there's the exception that proves the rule.
He's not the only one. Alex Witt, that blonde on MSNBC, she's Canadian also, and she's a right-winger. So
yeah.
They just all come down here.
Yeah, on the other hand, Leonard Cohen is a Canadian.
I know,
you
know, I know.
And he sings, Democracy is Coming to the USA, one of my favorite songs. In fact, we sort of used it as an unofficial theme song for a while.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, Canada doesn't have anywhere near they have their people, but they all tend to come down here.
Yeah.
And I really wish that they stay home and cause trouble.
Well, they're
coming down here.
The right wingers can make more money down here. The bottom line is this whole right wing infrastructure that's all set up for them. Dara, thank you very much for the call. That's an interesting point. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here. The place for tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker named Jeff Gannon. Yeah. Indeed. Our number, 1-866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466. Drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. Just click live chat, and it'll drop you in. We'll be right back.
It's the Al Franken Show with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
How one, Mr. Grinch. You're a nasty, wacky stump. Your heart is full of unwashed socks. Your soul is full of gunk, Mr. Grinch. The three words that best describe you are as follows, and I quote, stink, stank, stunk.
Yes. Long past time for the USA to stop the nonsense and institute profiling at airports.
Speaking of Mr. Grinch, welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. William in Los Angeles, California. Hey, William, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I really appreciate this discussion being brought up today. And that book you're reading from is really vital. I'm glad to bring it to this audience. But I wanted to talk to you about one point. You said that we are all racist.
Yes.
At one point. Do you mind? I've got a 20-second definition from the Dictionary of Racism. Can I read it to you?
Sure.
Racism, an excessive and irrational belief in or advocacy of the superiority of a given group, people, or nation on racial grounds alone. So I think what you were saying is everybody recognizes the other or difference, and that recognition is not racism. It is the belief that one group is superior to another group based on just the visual recognition. That's what determines racism.
And I think that at our deepest core, William, it would take a saint to say honestly that at no point in their life had they ever looked at somebody from another racial group and made internally in their own mind a generalized negative comment.
I don't agree with that. Listen, I'm an African American. I was raised in a virulently white racist neighborhood in the 60s. My father integrated this neighborhood. I think that sets the bar too high. They were white.
And you have never looked at white folks and made an internal comment to yourself that generalizes about white folks.
Not in terms of being superior, a human being or an inferior human being. No, I don't. That does not have to be in the picture. That's a choice people make.
Yeah.
You can
I'm agreeing with you broadly, but and perhaps you're just a far better man than I am. I certainly I don't walk around thinking that I'm racially superior to anybody. And I
well, that's what a racist is. That's
yeah,
what,
I understand.
You
I
can
understand
look at
that,
difference.
But,
you can
but,
look
I,
at
but
difference.
I really do think that most people at some point in their lives have had that experience. I don't know how to say it beyond that.
Well, even if you do have that experience at one point in your life, that too does not mean that you're a racist.
Yeah, okay. Well, then we're splitting hairs because...
Well, no, I think it's important because it's important to...
So you're saying that there's a difference between being racially aware and being a racist.
The Grand Canyon.
Yeah, okay. I'll go with you.
Can I just say one more thing? Just,
sure.
I've been looking at this for a long time. And the first person that I saw start to confuse the definition of racist so that it's kind of, oh, we're all racist, was David Duke back in the 80s. And it shocked me that everyone kind of went along with it. But look at the language of law. Look at how law was written from before the 70s through the Civil Rights Movement and then into the early 80s when it was an important thing to determine who was a racist and who was not.
Yeah.
And if we smear the line, we're really, I mean, we don't have any way to rationally, in an adult way, talk about this issue of racism.
That's a very good point, William. It's a very good point. I agree with you. And I will, let me recalibrate my statement then. We are all racially aware. We are all aware of people who are different. Not just racially aware. We're all gender aware. We're all height aware. We're all aware of who's different from us and who's not part of our immediate family.
Absolutely.
And some of us use that awareness to define we're better than, they're not as good as, or vice versa, actually, in some cases. And others of us just acknowledge that, hey, that awareness is in us, it's part of us as human beings, and we need to get it under control.
If you announce your email address, I'd love to send you some information on this.
It's on my website.
Okay, if you could just announce it on the radio again, because I don't have it.
Yeah, it's Tom at TomHartman.com, T-H-O-M, Tom Hartman, T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's.com.
I really enjoy this conversation. Keep it up. Thank you.
Thanks, William. Thanks for listening there. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service is with us. We'll continue with your phone calls on this topic and more as we bridge the news over the top of the hour. But I wanted to get a quick report in here from Washington, D.C. Victoria, the president gave a speech this morning. What's the story here?
Well, the story is, despite the fact, by the way, that I wore red, I've got red hair and a new hairstyle. Once again, Tom, you'll be not surprised to hear he didn't call on me.
No, Victoria. You know, you've gotten Tony Snook, you know, actually getting into a few little fights with you, so...
I know. I think I was on the blacklist today. The president reiterated we're not winning and we're not losing in Iraq, but he was asked a direct question by Terry Hunt of Reuters, who's a very good journalist, to basically explain what he meant, and seemed to be incapable of doing so. So we didn't get any further on that. He did confirm that he was looking at a surge in troops, but again, it was unclear exactly what the surge meant and what they were surging for to do.
Did anybody ask him about the aircraft carrier battleship group that is now steaming toward Iran? That was just announced yesterday?
No, that was not us.
Because I think that's the thing that really shocked me. I mean, no, Iran is fairly close to completing their oil bores. I mean, they're actually building a whole building complex for it on this island, the Shakhtov Island or something like that. You know, it's just off the coast of Iran, and they announced 3 days ago that they were no longer going to hold their foreign currencies in dollars, but rather going to shift to euros. And now they're talking about having an oil bores in euros, where all the Middle Eastern countries can buy and sell oil in euros. And all of a sudden, Bush sends a carrier fleet there, and it's spooking me, Victoria. It's spooking me. So
I'll not disagree.
Yeah, and you'll keep your ears and eyes open and let us know about your thoughts on this as time goes on.
I will. I definitely will. It's a very interesting story.
Thank you very kindly, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com on the internet, White House reporter. Great talking with you. Oops, off she goes. Great talking with you, Victoria. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio. We'll continue with this topic and more news of the day. There's a lot going on. We'll get back into that. But I do want to carry on this discussion of how are we being manipulated in the United States and how can we push back against it? 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, you will recall Mr. O'Reilly's famous words. Welcome back, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you. The question, how does a nation slide from being a democratic republic, from being an egalitarian society, where free speech is not just valued but enshrined in your founding documents and enforced by the law of the land? How do you slide from that to being a state where people are simply vanished? Whether they are undocumented workers, whether they are terror suspects like Jose Padilla, who now is no longer charged with any terror crimes. How do you make that transition? I would submit to you that a good chunk of what makes that transition is people in the media urging it.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Yeah, very funny, Bill. Very, very funny. And now Mike Gallagher, one of the guys who was invited to sit with George W. Bush, one of the right-wing talk show hosts, to broadcast from the White House. One of the women on The View, right? This TV show, women's TV show, by and large, I suppose, you know, target audience, made a comparison between Don Rumsfeld and Adolf Hitler. Right? They're both war criminals. I'll go on record as saying I think they're both war criminals. I don't think that there's a good, clean comparison between Rumsfeld and Hitler. Hitler was a maniacal madman who murdered tens of millions, you know, the consequence of his actions was the death of tens of millions of people. Don Rumsfeld, he's a small-time mass murderer. You know, just a few hundred thousand people who have died as a result of his actions. But they're both war criminals. So she points this out, and Mike Gallagher goes nuts.
Just for Joy Behar, I think we ought to round up all these folks, round up Joy Behar, round up Matt Damon, who last night on MSNBC attacked George Bush and Dick Cheney, round up Olbermann, take the whole bunch of them and put them in a detention camp until this war is over, because they're a bunch of traitors.
They're not traitors, they're Americans. You know what the great thing about America?
There you go. Yeah, that's the rebuttal. They're a bunch of traitors. And what did Matt Damon say? That he should be put into a concentration camp for? I mean, did you get this? This is Mike Gallagher, the right-wing talk show host, friend of George W. Bush, saying that Matt Damon should be put in a concentration camp. What did he say that was worthy of that?
By everybody, you know, and if the president has daughters who are of age, then maybe they should go too.
Yeah, this sacrifice of the war should be shared by everybody. And if the president has daughters who are of age, maybe they should go too. Yeah, that's worth putting somebody in a concentration camp, for sure. You get it? When Milton Mayer writes about this, and they thought they were free, here's another one of his friends. He says, I do not see even now how we could have stopped it. Many times since it happened, I have pondered that pair of great maxims, Principis Obsta and Finem Respis, Latin for resist the beginnings and consider the end. But one must foresee the end in order to resist or even see the beginnings. One must foresee the end clearly and certainly. And how is this to be done by ordinary men or even by extraordinary men? Our attorney general designated, you know, well, now he's the head of the Justice Department. Our ex-attorney general calls the Geneva Conventions quaint. Our ex-secretary of state stands accused of ordering torture. Our president and vice president knowingly lie us into a war. Lie the world into it. Why? In order to lead an election year stunt in 2000. And Congress passes national security bills without even reading them, eerily like the German parliament pushing through the enabling acts after the Reichstaggebäude was burned. I really don't want this to be framed in the context of these guys are evil and I'm standing here complaining about it. Because the most horrible reality of all of this is that I believe, and I really truly believe this, that Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and George W. Bush and Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Fife and Richard Pearl that all of these guys and their enablers in the House and the Senate, both Republicans and Democrats, that when they go to bed at night or when they look themselves in the mirror in the morning, they say, you're a good person, you're doing a good job, you're trying to keep the world safe. I really believe that these people think, by and large, I mean, yeah, there's, you know, see, you'll notice I didn't include Karl Rove in that list. I really, though, believe, by and large, most of these people have developed rationalizations that allow them to engage in this kind of behavior, because when you can't rationalize your behavior, your world collapses. That all of us want to be good people. All of us think that we are deep down inside. And the goal on this side, whether you want to call what I'm doing the left or the middle, I would never mainstream. No, mainstream media is the problem. That's the right wing. But, you know, those of us on the left, let's say, even though, you know, I make the point, the real left, the Communist Party, just, you know, it's not even around anymore. But I mean, it is, but for all practical purposes. But those of us who call ourselves progressives and liberals have to acknowledge, before we can do anything about this, that the people on the other side who are using fear, who are promoting fear in order to achieve their goals, you know, George W. Bush, with his speech at the Republican National Committee.
Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on...
And it goes on. You've heard me play it before. That we have to acknowledge that even in what they are doing, that they themselves actually are afraid. And they're projecting that fear onto all of the rest of us, trying to cause all the rest of us to fear it, to feel it. And yes, you know, they're accomplishing some political ends, and yes, they're accomplishing some financial ends, and they're making themselves wealthy and all that kind of stuff. You know, the CEOs of the largest defense contractors since the war in Iraq began have paid themselves collectively over $1,000 billion, $1 trillion, according to Jim Hightower. It's pretty amazing. There's some serious war profiteering going on. And yet, at the end of the day, I guarantee you, all of these people will tell you, oh, I'm just doing what has to be done. It's the right thing. It's the good thing. And as long as we demonize the other side, as long, you know, when you've got guys, you know, on the right, like Mike Gallagher, saying that people like me should be put in jail, that we should be hauled off the detention camps. When you've got guys like Savage saying, you know, everybody should be murdered. Right?
Some bloodthirsty religionists practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks are where to kill them.
If we respond in kind, we're screwed. This is the big crisis. Professor Jack Davis, the University of, or Jack Forbes, rather, at the University of California, Davis, gave me some real insight into this. I interviewed him back 10 years ago when I was writing my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, about peak oil and how culture has led to all that. And he said, and he's a professor of Native American studies and a Native American himself, and he said, Native Americans in this country were confronted with crazy people who came from Europe who thought that killing people was acceptable, massacring people was acceptable, stealing land was acceptable. He said there were virtually no tribes in North America who believed that. They would have conflicts, they'd have fights, they'd have wars, but you don't want somebody else's land, you get their ghosts. He said, we call this Wetiko. This insanity, this cannibalism, eating the lives of others. And so the Native Americans were confronted with these horrible choices. Do we flee, as the Shoshone did, for example, because they had enough geographic space to do it? Or do we stand up, you know, just stand our ground and die, as many, many did? Or do we fight back? And if we fight back, we risk becoming them. And so I think that it's really important that we speak out, that we speak up, but that we use as our role models Jesus and Gandhi and Martin Luther King, who said, no, we're not going to back down from this. We are going to speak the truth. And you can yell all day long about how we should be dragged off and put in internment camps, and you can even do it, but we're going to continue speaking our truth. And we are not going to become the evil that we are decrying. We're not going to become whiners and complainers. We're not going to become haters. We are patriots. We believe in the ideals of this country. We are Americans. We trust the American people. We put democracy and the values of this country, on which this country was founded, yes, imperfectly acted out at times, we put those values at the top of the list, and we are going to live and embody those values in our lives. We'll be back with your calls right after this. 866-440-THON. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain! Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some.
It's the Al Franken Show with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
The values of humanity, whatever happened to the fairness and equality? Instead of spreading love, we're spreading animosity. Lack of understanding leading us away from unity. That's the reason why sometimes I'm feeling under. That's the reason why sometimes I'm feeling down. It's no wonder why sometimes I'm feeling under. Gotta keep my faith alive, love is found.
Welcome back to listener-supported radio, 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, it's our program supported by you, the listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen for the sponsors on your local stations, and please patronize them. Let them know that you're listening. And also our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, sacredgroundscoffee.com, and Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com. Get the latest iPods now. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Richard in Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure talking to you. Speaking of local sponsors, here in Boston, we're losing our Air America station as of tomorrow. We'd hear you on the weekends only here, Tom, your eloquence on the weekends, so I'd always catch you then.
Thank you, Richard.
Yeah, look, there's almost difference between the neocons and the neoliberals, Tom. They both support WTO. They both support the globalization. They both.
Well, let's just make sure that everybody understands the definitions.
All right.
The neoconservatives are the group that came out of Leo Strauss's work at the University of Chicago in the 1950s and 60s, who basically believe that the end justifies the means, that religion should be used as a way of manipulating the people, and that America should be empire and exercise muscular military activity in order to end the terror is one of, or fear of military assault is one of the most powerful weapons that a nation can wield. The neoliberals are, that's a phrase that is used more in Europe and Canada than in the United States. I don't think most Americans would recognize that phrase. Neoliberalism is really, in today in America, probably what would be called libertarianism or conservatism. And that's the theory that governments should not interfere in international trade policies, that corporations should be making decisions about economies, that government shouldn't be standing in on behalf of workers or on behalf of specific industries to keep them safe and within nations.
Well, thanks for clarifying that, Tom. I guess I misunderstood the term, but
neoliberalism is an old philosophy. Neoconservatism is only about 50 years old.
But let's say, Tom, though, both parties here support all these things I just said,
sure,
plus the 750 bases I think we have throughout the world. I think the only South America is the only area now that's really independent from us, and getting more so. You know, the stranglehold we had on them in the past is slowly withering away.
Well, in some places, in other places like in Colombia, it's actually strengthening.
That's
in
true.
Peru.
Yeah, that's true. But Tom, you know who epitomizes? I think I know Hillary Clinton conveniently finally decided to, you know, saying that she wouldn't, if she knew now what she knew then, she wouldn't have voted for the war.
And God bless her for it. You know, I think we need to acknowledge that.
Yeah, but she's also said things in the past that's just as hardline against Iran as McCain or Bush. So,
yeah.
You know, anyway, but thanks so much, Tom, and I'm going to miss hearing you on the weekends.
Well, you know, hopefully some other station in Boston will say, hey, there's some money laying around on the ground here to be made, and we need to pick up Air America's programming because, you know, if in my opinion, if a station... I'm broadcasting from KPOJ here in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
And this station is just ripping up the pavement. I mean, they're making money hand over
fist. You're lucky. You're in a wonderful city. And
It's not because it's Portland, I'm telling you. It's because it's good management at the station. And anyhow, Richard, thanks for the call. I appreciate your kind words. And I don't want to get into that. I don't want to get into trashing our affiliates. There's a lot of people in this business who are working really hard and a lot, you know, trying to make it work. Karen in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Karen.
Yes.
And this is really, really disturbing to me. I was going to talk about, oh, boy, we have the same problem as Boston.
I know, and let's not get into it because it's just not going to be a productive conversation. And, and really, we need to let the radius. Trust me, Karen, eventually the market is going to work all this stuff out. I wrote an article back 4 years ago called Talking Back to Talk Radio on commondreams.org. You can find it over at tomharbin.com on the articles on democracy. It was the original article that said there is a market for progressive talk radio. Shelley and Anita Drobny took that article and invented Air America Radio as a result of it. I started on Sirius Satellite Radio with IE America Radio Network with Mike Malloy at about that time, and then they started Air America. So we were like doing these parallel tracks. And I still believe I was, not just believe I was right, I can prove that I was right. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, six out of the nine last months in Seattle, for example, in the station that I'm on there, Talk 1090, I'd even beat Rush Limbaugh. It is progressive talk radio works, and if a particular station can't make it work, well, you know, thanks for the good try. We appreciate it. Hopefully somebody else will pick it.
Well, I do have something else. The original reason why I called is I love the way you use history to give us perspective. There's an excellent book, two chapters in particular, in William L. Shire's book.
Yes, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich.
Yeah, the two chapters on the Nazification of Germany, and the one...
Karen, let me put you on hold, and we'll come back to this, because we do have to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. And, you know, we'll come back to that. As long as you're not going to read. We don't let people read on the air. It'll crash a program. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back. We're not going to shut our eyes. We're not going to stop talking until they kill us off. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Sometimes you think God is talking to you, right? It's over at thinkprogress.org. Not me personally, but you know us collectively. Over at thinkprogress.org, they have a map of the United States put together by the... let's see. Who is it put together by? The U.S. Drought Monitor, the National Climatic Data Center. Climatic data center. Yeah. It's about climate, not climax. Anyway, and it shows where the drought is happening in the United States, where the most severe drought and huge wildfires as a consequence of it. Where? In the home state of James Inhofe, the head of the Senate Environment Committee, who has been claiming that global warming is a hoax, and in the state of George W. Bush, who has brought us no emissions controls. How weird is that? You can see it over at thinkprogress.org. It is downright spooky. Anyhow, Karen, you were gonna make a point about William Scherer's book, The Rise and the Fall of the Third Reich.
Right. Thank you. The two chapters I found, so it's a huge book, 1,100 pages. Two chapters that are pertinent to now: the Nazification of Germany, 1933 to 1934, and Life in the Third Reich, 1933 to 1937, and he touches upon how it is living there and how the press turned, well, radio at that time was taken over by the Nazis, and when you don't have a free press, you think that's the truth.
Yeah, and you know, Hitler got into bed with the corporations or brought them in, the largest corporations in the state. I mean, that is the definition of fascism, the merging of business and state interests.
Right.
It's the largest definition. And although, frankly, the real fascists were Mussolini and Franco. They were just, you know, pure fascists. Hitler was not just a fascist. He was also a madman and a mass murderer. So it's a little difficult. I am wary of calling Hitler a fascist because he went so far beyond that. But nonetheless, yeah, you're absolutely right. And in fact, at the end of Scherer's book, in the last chapters, I recall, and it's been 15, 20 years since I read it, there are a couple of paragraphs where he talks about his fear of the rise of fascism in the United States. And probably the folks in our chat room, actually, it's a great Google fest. Somebody will find it real quickly and toss it to me, and I'll share it with you. But, Karen, thank you for calling and for sharing that with us.
And I have a question. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by pushback? How do we push back?
You mean against the Reich, against the
right.
What's happening?
Well, The first thing we did was vote. And
yes.
7,000 miles, but...
And that's a significant pushback. I think that we push back by writing letters to the editor of our newspapers, by letting our elected officials know what our opinions are, by showing up every month, if the meetings are monthly or every quarter or every year, whatever it may be, at the local party headquarters, your county Democratic Party or your Green Party or even the Republican Party, if you're so inclined. We need good people in the Republican Party as well. We need to take back our political process. We need to show up at those meetings. We need to get active. We need to obviously, as I said, contact our elected officials, but, you know, at least once a week, call one of your elected officials, one of your senators, one of your House representatives. Don't forget the local officials. A lot of people forget about their state representatives and their state senators. This is not only the breeding ground, the training pen for the next generation. It's also, you know, where a lot of opinion is being formed and a lot of laws are being made. Call talk show hosts like you're doing right now. Call into talk shows, even the right wing ones, and talk back to them. Talk to your friends and neighbors. Talk over the water cooler. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I have conservatives on this program at least 3 or 4 times a week and debate them is to prove that it is possible to talk to these folks and at the end of the day still have a decent relationship, that there doesn't need to be blood on the floor when you're done. And we need to engage the other side. So that's my definition, Karen. Thank you very much for the call, by the way. I appreciate it. Marianne in Arcata, California. Hey, Marianne, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning, Tom. It's so good to talk to you and listen to your program. I have a comment, and I think that new members of Congress should be sworn in on the Constitution. I think they should print up a copy of the Constitution and then put it in a nice leather binding,
mm-hmm.
and take it out every time they need to swear someone in.
Now, as opposed to the Bible. You know, in fact, they're not sworn in on anything. The actual swearing-in ceremony does not involve any sort of implement or instrument or anything.
Yeah,
that's a photo op that they do later with the Bible. But they do, you know, they do swear an oath to protect and defend the Constitution.
So
not the nation, but the Constitution. So in a way, they are sworn in on the Constitution.
So why does the new, this new Muslim member, he says he wants to be sworn in on the Quran.
Right. Here's how it works. Here's how it works. There is a swearing-in ceremony where everybody from Congress, you know, whoever's being the new members, they all get together, and the Speaker of the House, says, you know, raise your right hand, or whoever it is, you know, the Vice President, I don't know who it is who does the swearing-in, says raise your right hand. Everybody raises their right hand and takes the oath to protect and defend the Constitution. Then they're legally sworn in.
Mm-hmm.
Then most of them after that, pardon?
Yeah.
Okay, and then after that, most of them then go to a photographer, very often in their own office, and they'll have somebody hand them a Bible, or they'll put their hand on a Bible, and they'll hold their hand up, and they'll have a photo taken, and that photo goes out to their constituents. But the actual legal swearing in has nothing to do with the Bible. But what Keith Ellison wanted to do is, if everybody's going to have their photo op with their hand on a Bible, because he's Muslim, he wanted to have his photo op with his hand on a Quran. And that's what we're all yelling and arguing about. Weird as it sounds, is the photo op. It doesn't even have to do with the legal process of swearing in.
Yeah, no, it really shouldn't be. Because I think a lot of people don't realize that Quran, it contains Sharia law for the Muslims.
Well, you know, so does the Bible. I mean, you can go back and read Leviticus and Deuteronomy if you want to get into it. I mean, the bottom line is that we do not swear in people on religious documents in the United States. Some of our elected officials use religious documents for photo ops after the fact. That's the bottom line. Christian in Palm Springs, California. Hey, Christian. Christian?
Yes.
Hey, you're on the air. What's up?
I thank you much. Okay, read this about 10 years ago in the Los Angeles Times. This teacher in Los Angeles Unified School District was teaching world history, and he told his class, he would do this about every 4 years. He told his class, he said, we're going to drop from the German unit and go to the China unit. He said, the reason is that we're going to have some Chinese acrobats visit our class. The class got all excited and everything. Then he says, we have one little problem. The Chinese believe that blondes are the devil. There were three blonde students in the class. The other students were looking toward them, and they said, the blonde students said, this is crazy. Why should we leave just because someone's coming and doesn't like us? And the other students formed their arguments that they were selfish, the blonde ones, that if they went to China, they'd want to flaunt their rules. The end of it was the blonde students were forced to leave the class by the students. The teacher just watched.
Right, and this is not even a belief held by the Chinese, by the way. This is a variation on the old brown-eye, blue-eye thing that was done back in the 60s.
After they were out, he brought the blonde students back and said, we have not left the German unit. This to show how people can be driven out by public opinion.
That's brilliant. Christian, thank you for sharing that story with us.
You're very welcome.
I appreciate it. Yeah, the similar one is in the 60s where the teacher, two teachers back in two schools, in one school they taught them in the classroom that brown eyes indicated superiority, and the other was blue eyes indicated superiority, and immediately the classes began to divide socially within the classes based on their eye color. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. David in San Francisco, listening on the Quake. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, howdy, Tom. You know, I hadn't listened to you for a couple of weeks, and I heard an interview with, there's an organization of scientists that have been putting together various petitions regarding the maluse of sciences. I believe that's HEER.org. And they've recently disclosed that Bush, and this has especially happened since the election, Bush is shutting down the EPA libraries.
Yes, all around the country.
Right.
The official position is that they are consolidating resources.
Right, which doesn't make any sense because putting all your eggs in one basket has always been a stupid idea.
Well, it's also making it much more difficult for regional EPA offices to work, and it's making it much more difficult for the states to work with the EPA. And that's, of course, the Bush's goal.
Right. Well, and then, so that comes to what you've been talking about for the last hour, essentially, whether or not these people are fools and incompetents or whether they're saboteurs. I still contend they're saboteurs.
Oh, I don't disagree that they're saboteurs. What I'm saying is they think that they're saboteurs of a bad system and that they are moving us toward a good system. These are people who truly believe that there is such a thing as a free market. They don't realize that markets exist on the substrate of a government that creates the currency and the laws of the rules of the market, you know, the rules of exchange and court systems that allow you to enforce contracts. I mean, they think that there's this abstraction called the free market, for example. And I mean, they truly believe their own ideology. And in pursuing that ideology, they do things that to us look stupid, but to them seem perfectly rational.
Well, I'll tell you, if you go to the great philosopher Will Rogers, he wrote a great book back in the 30s, I believe. It was called The Illiterate Digest. And in there, he's got a really nice anti-war piece, and he talks about how the money, we should draft capital in times of war. And specifically, he talks about the idea that businessmen are specifically making their money on American dollars. And American dollars are based upon the loyalty to America. When these
good point. David, I'm sorry we're out of time, but excellent point and well made. Thank you very much. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Through a hole in the air, from those nets, Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there.
You tell him, Leonard. Spoken like a good Canadian. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Harbin here with you. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. You know, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you know, sometimes you don't even know what you don't know that you don't know, and sometimes...
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind. Everything you know is wrong.
Yeah, maybe. You know, once a week we try to take a short segment and break from politics and... check into, well, maybe Everything You Know Is Wrong. Our Everything You Know Is Wrong today is sponsored by LiberalStore.com. All things liberal and bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Go check out the liberal teddy bear there now. That's LiberalStore.com. John Curtis is with us. He's the author of The Business of Love. His website, thebusinessoflove.org. A new book saying, John, you say that we should run our relationships like a business?
Well, why not? I mean, nothing else seems to be working. You know, the divorce rate's been hovering. One out of two marriages have been failing since the 1980s. It's time for a change.
So should I outsource my sex life to the hooker down the street?
If we can talk about that on the air, we will gladly do it. But you certainly may want to outsource some other things. You know, there's even a service, and this is California, of course, where this happens. You can outsource the potty training of your child. But the point is,
I don't think that's healthy. Frankly, I have to say, I said that tongue in cheek. Louise and I have been married 35 years, and frankly, it gets better over time rather than worse. All aspects of it, business seems to me like a really dysfunctional model. I'm sorry.
Well, it depends on the business. You're absolutely right. The main thing is look at the tools that an effective business should use to put in place at the beginning to be profitable. A vision statement, where are we headed as an organization? Job descriptions, performance appraisal process that's productive and meaningful to the employees. The ability to put in place a good benefits and compensation package. You can do the same thing in your marriage.
Yeah.
You know, keep in mind, it may not sound very romantic, but the thing that destroys romance more than anything else in marriages today is power struggles over things like who's going to take out the trash.
Or typically money.
Money is right there. Money and chores and kids. And so this is an attempt, especially for the dual career couples, to say, time for a different model. What mom
John,
and dad used didn't work.
In all seriousness, the part of your book that I actually, not to diminish the other parts of your book, but the part of your book that I thought was really, really useful was where you articulated, and this has been said in other areas about other things. Community, for example, is I think the realm in which it was first expressed in several books over the years. The five stages of intimacy.
Yes.
You want to go through those?
Well, you know, this is so much, you know, love is blind and marriage is an institution for the blind. I know that's a trite cliche, but, you know, so many folks get hung up in the romance and the starry-eyed and the fantasy and everything will be wonderful, and it's truly a false state. You know, we're marketing to one another. We're putting our best foot forward, and you're going to outgrow that. You're going to move beyond that at some point in time. And then, predictably, if you move into a stage of commitment, now it's like, I got you. You know, we're monogamous. Maybe we're living together. And then the conflicts are going to begin to surface. That's the next stage, and this is where couples either, you know, throw in the towel and give up, or, in fact, they decide to get married. As a guy said to me recently, the only way I knew to get rid of this woman was to marry her so I could divorce her. But the next stage,
ouch,
if folks are successful, they get through the conflicts, they understand a mature adult perspective of marriage, and then they move to real intimacy and not just false romance. That's the stuff, frankly, you might have with your wife after 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're real, you're vulnerable, you know each other's faults, and you still love each other. That's reality. But if you did that in the first date, the fifth date, the person wouldn't want to go out with you again.
Sure.
You know, so it takes time to get through those stages, and most folks just think, oh, well, the intimacy and the throbbing of my heart has worn off, therefore there must be something wrong with the relationship. No, that's when you're just getting to the real stuff.
Yeah. Now, one of the other real things about, you know, making a relationship work is learning where the other person's belt line is and not ever hitting them below it, you know, emotionally. We all know the words that we can use to wound other people that we're close with. And once we learn those words or those actions, we need to make a real serious commitment not to take them. On the other hand, in the business world, if I know what my competitor's vulnerability is, I'm going to go for it. How do you reconcile that with the premise of your book?
Well, and we're not talking about when the business model is presented is what are the kinds of things you as a business person, you're going to small business administration in your local hometown and they say, what do I need to do to set up my own small business? This is about learning from those strategies as opposed to the cutthroat competitive marketplace. Mm-hmm. So the key thing is take the best from the business world, the importance of clarity in job descriptions, a productive performance appraisal process, branding and marketing. How do you brand a marriage? Well,
how do you brand a marriage?
Well, my wife and I call it a love logo. Also, I got a couple sits at the kitchen table. They got a couple pairs of scissors, and they got a bunch of magazines, and they work on cutting out images and make a collage. Or I had a couple recently that cut out a silhouette of a lion's head and said, this is what our marriage is about, bravery and courage and doing the right thing.
See,
put that on the refrigerator.
In psychology, you'd call that an anchor. You'd say that's, or it could be just a picture of your wedding picture, for example, is for a lot of people the anchor,
Bingo.
Hang on the wall, and every time you look at it, it reminds you of why you got married in the first place.
Desktop of your computer is that's the kind of thing we're talking about with creating a love logo. Just like the Nike Swish or the Apple computer Apple, we see this image and it reminds us of what's important to us.
Interesting stuff. John Curtis, the Business of Love, thebusinessoflove.org. Thanks, John, for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Good conversation. An interesting topic.
Thank you.
Coming up on the next program, Russ Feingold, U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, is dropping by. He has some strong thoughts on the Baker Commission. I'll be challenging Mark Morano on global warming. Who says scare tactics shouldn't drive public policy? It's the Tom Hartman radio program, also filling in for Al Franken this week, your radio support group next week as well, for We the People of the United States of America. And don't ever forget, democracy starts with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.